Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. I'm Zach Weaver, and you are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 15, Episode 3, The Alibi. This week, we went through the details of Jody's alibi. We also got to hear from Jody themselves. This episode raised a lot of questions, and Bob, Janet, and I are going to do our best to get them all answered. Before we get into that, Bob, do we have anything we want to address off the top?
First thing, Janet, I know I asked you to make a note of this, but I remembered all by myself.
Nice.
Because I forgot last week. We need to, so every season, we have our amazing team of volunteer transcribers that transcribe all the episodes for us. And usually most seasons, somebody who is like in regular communication with the person in prison will actually like print and mail the transcripts to them so they can read what's happening in the case. And so I was talking to Erica Cantor, who's kind of running the transcription team now, to see if there's anybody that can do that. Erica has volunteered to do it, but I told her that I wanted to put it out to see if anybody, because I know there's so many that are always looking for a way to help, because there's some expense involved too. And I'm happy to reimburse people for postage if they want to do that. But I wanted to put it out there. If there's anybody that would like to take up that job to print out the transcripts and mail them to Jody in prison, shoot us an email or a message and let us know. Like I said, Erica said she's willing to do it, but she's already doing so much that I just don't want to put that much more on her, because she's transcribing episodes. She's kind of helping organize that whole process. Tool girl in the chat already says I'll do it. Great. Tool girl, shoot me an email. Anybody else, shoot a message, because maybe we can split the workload up a little bit too. It's not a lot of work, but like I said, there's a little time and expense, because every week, you know, whenever the transcripts get done, you've got to print them out. You got to package them, physically mail them to the prison. And you can't do, Jody said they can't get like big bulk mail. Like you can't send them a whole big batch of them all at once. They said like 15, 20 pages is fine. But if you send like a 50 page bundle, they'll reject it. They'll consider that bulk mail, and because they have to review it before they give it to them. So they have to get like mailed one episode at a time. So yeah, shoot us, and Tara Betts, oh, thank you, Tara, also says she's here in Michigan and could do it. Might be cheaper for postage. Yeah, so guys, shoot us an email, theories@truthandjusticepod.com. If you are interested in helping out with that, seems like we got a bunch of people that are, and that'll be great, because I want Jody to read what's going on, and I'm dying to talk to them right now too, because they're on lockdown. I got a message last week that said there's a lot of violence in the unit and they're threatening lockdown, and so they don't know when they'll be able to talk to me again. And so some of the questions that you guys have coming up, I've been trying to get the answers for, but I'm not just waiting for Jody to get back with me about that. So. There was something else I was going to say. Don't remember what it was. So I guess we'll continue on with whatever. What other notes do you have, Janet?
I don't have anything other than just us diving into probably our own thoughts about the episode and then getting into the listener questions.
Sounds good. I was hoping there was something else at the top of my mind that was a for sure housekeeping thing.
The only thing you asked me to remember was the transcription stuff.
Yeah. And then it popped out. Yeah. What do you guys think? Alibi.
First, forget the alibi at the moment. It was great to hear from Jody.
Yes.
That was huge. So I'm very happy that they were able to speak with us, speak with you. We could hear their story.
I realize I just asked you to start talking, and I just remembered the thing.
Perfect.
I don't think anyone's surprised.
You reminded me.
Good.
The other thing I wanted to mention is I kind of forgot to write it into the episode in the last segment when Jody was talking about their biography. And people were asking about helping with stamps and stuff like that so that they could do it. They have sent it to me. I have 100 emails from Jody because they could only send them like one page at a time. So we have those now in our JPay inbox. And so what we're planning to do, we just haven't had the time to get it done. And also we've been having a computer issue in the office here, is Erica's going to take all those, like copy and paste them into a document because we got to get them. You know, Jody sent them in order, but they didn't come in order. So we got to go through and like get them all ordered, get them into one document. And then I want to publish that for Jody so that that'll be available to everyone. So that is coming. I had a couple people, Kathy said, you know, they're willing to help do the editing work. I appreciate it. I have to get into my JPay account and copy and paste them. And so like once we've that's the whole job. So like once we do that for me to copy and paste it and send it to you for you, there's nothing left to do. So we're going to take care of that. And the last thing that I also want to say is I was out to dinner last night with it's actually Erica's parents who are listening, and they just wanted to they were talking about the case documents, where we find them. And I told her like the website's in the credits, but just now up front, just let everybody, if anybody's looking for the case documents on our website, our website is truthandjusticepod.com. So if you go to truthandjusticepod.com, right, there's a splash screen right at the beginning that'll ask you if you want to go to the case documents. And with that, what else did you have, Zach?
Past hearing from Jody, I mean, the episode was broke down really well. It's really interesting to hear the alibi that was brought up and all the people that kind of confirmed what we were believing. So there's a lot of questions that I think I can jump into, but that's what I have at the moment.
Okay.
That look says that you are looking at me to say how I felt, because even though people listen to this podcast orally and would not know that you were looking at me, yes, thank you for asking me how I feel. No, I thought that it was a great episode. Loved, I agree with Zach, wonderful to hear from Jody. Definitely left me wanting so much more. I don't know if tantalizing is the right word, but certainly just hearing bits and pieces about Jody's life and kind of jumping ahead to experiences that Jody has had while in prison. Not an easy listen, very frustrating and hard to just hear about things that are going on. But I'm so excited for us to all be involved. And certainly there are people who want to know, just to kind of tag on to what you were saying earlier about the transcripts and getting stuff mailed and all of that stuff. People are already clamoring to help however they can. Can they correspond with Jody? Can they send music to Jody? And stuff like that. Do you have an answer for that yet?
Yeah. So on our website, I think Katie has on the website, because I gave her the inmate ID number. So the best way to communicate with Jody is through JPay. They have an app. It's super easy. You set up the JPay app and then you can just email. I believe Jody has a tablet on their end, and you can just email back and forth. That's the best way to correspond with Jody. And all you need to do is look them up by their inmate ID number. Again, that should be on the website. If not, like if you can't find it, their inmate ID number, I think somebody even posted it on our Facebook page. But also if you just go to the Michigan Online Offender lookup Joseph Hill, and you can get the inmate ID number. And with that, you can just pop onto JPay and communicate with them. The last email that I sent to Jody was asking, is there a way for them to listen to music or for someone to gift them music?
Great.
But they're on lockdown right now, so I haven't got that response back. Because I believe there is. I don't know exactly how that'll work. So I'll let you know as soon as I hear from that.
Great. I had a lot of questions come up for this episode. Definitely my top question was also the top question from our very astute listeners who immediately picked up on it and were like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So we had a bunch of people kind of weigh in with the same big question. So I thought we would start with that whenever you guys are ready.
We're ready.
Well, when I heard that just Jody mentioned in passing that their former foster mother was on their jury, I had to full stop and go back and listen again, even though I was sure I had heard everything right. It was only for the purpose of like trying to mitigate my shock, and that it was just kind of like, oh, as an aside, like, by the way. So everybody, Ashton, Veronica, Rebecca, Christy, Sarah, everybody wants to know, how did that happen? Was that a known thing at the time? Is there more to the story? How?
The only thing I know about it right now, because we're going to go through in a minute here, I'll explain kind of the process too, because people had questions about this too. But I haven't like dug through the voir dire process yet to figure out how that happened. But my understanding is that it was known, because if anybody's never been on a jury or been through voir dire, you know, they'll ask you, do you have any connection to anybody on the jury that are, you know, the defendant, the prosecutors, the defense, the judge, anything, the police officers? So my assumption is that she would have said, yes, I used to be the foster mom. And then they would ask and then they'll ask, do you think you can still be objective? And apparently she said yes. And then neither side decided to strike her. Because what happens is it gets a little tricky because both sides they can strike anybody for cause. But then they also have their peremptory strikes where they can, for no reason whatsoever. The problem is if somebody says, like in any case, say they say, I know the cop. I know personally the police officer that was involved in this. And then they say, do you think that you can still be objective and fair? If they say yes, then you can't strike them for cause. You can try to make the argument to the judge.
Yeah.
So then you have to use a peremptory strike to get rid of them. And I would assume the defense, well, I don't know, because there was kind of that relationship didn't sound like it ended very well with Jody and the foster parent. So I don't know. I was shocked to hear it too, that the foster mother was on there. But when we get into the voir dire process, we'll talk about that. Because I don't exactly know just from what I've heard, because I haven't been through that part of the transcripts yet.
Okay. Yeah. Fascinating. Okay, so lots of kind of clarifications, lots of trying to build out from information that you let us in on for this episode. I don't know if we even have the answers yet or if they're coming in the future. Let's just jump in with Sarah, who says, Jody's girlfriend was called to testify, but saying her mom and kids said that Jody was home all night is hearsay. Did anyone bother calling her mom to testify? And I'll just add to that really quick. Probably should have set it up this way. But that piece was also so fascinating. The idea that, you know, the way this case is processed, and maybe it speaks to how many cases are coming through that court and how many cases that, you know, defense attorneys, public defenders, and prosecutors are dealing with. But the idea that we all have seen, even if we're not true crime fans, even if you've just seen a couple procedurals on television or in films, the whole cliche of don't ask a question you don't know the answer to just feels so apt in this situation, as it would seem that the prosecutor just read the police file, never spoke to the detective. Like, where's the disconnect there that the prosecutor's like, so you no idea? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So I think, and we're going to get pretty heavily into that this week in this week's episode. But no, I think the prosecutor spoke with the detective. The defense attorney was clearly extremely unprepared for this trial.
Right.
There's a situation that comes up in this week's episode that was such a glaring, huge, massive misstep by the defense. And it was very clearly from not being prepared. But it's also not entirely the defense attorney's fault, because so what's going on right now, like this episode you guys just heard, has prompted me, like I'm on the horn all over the place right now trying to figure out where documents are, who had them when. As an example, the timesheet was in the police file that was obtained by someone after the trial. I'm trying to figure out now, was the timesheet in the discovery that the defense attorney had? Because it's like in the file, it's in the police file, but it never comes up at trial. It's never, like, the defense never raises it at trial. The defense never brings it up. As far as we know, from what I'm hearing, the defense didn't have it or didn't realize they had it at trial.
Mm.
And you're going to hear that because of a lot of the way things were done, the defense wasn't worried about wasn't focused at all on work being the alibi. And it was either complete incompetence by the defense attorney or things were hidden from the defense attorney leading up to the trial.
Right.
As far as the mother, same thing. So this was some of the frustration you were hearing from me in this episode and that's why I wanted you to hear in her words what Sherelle said when they said, well, you never told any investigators that your mother was home. And she's like, yes, I did. I mean, she said, they're lying.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. And by the way, she's handicapped and lives with me. I'm not saying she stopped by that night. She lives there.
Right.
Well, the problem is, and of course, we don't have a recording of that transcript. So imagine you're the defense attorney and all you have to work with is the police file. And you look at the report and the report says Jody's home from work at 11. That's it. And then you'll hear in other episodes, there were You know, other witnesses were the report on them, say that they picked up Sherelle at 11 o'clock. And then she says Jody was home at 11 o'clock. And then somebody else says that they picked Sherelle up or Sherelle picked them up. And so they're able to like paint this picture through the police reports that everybody's getting their times wrong or they're and present it to the jury as though everybody's lying. But none of them are the people's actual words. So if the defense attorney, who I was told didn't even speak to Jody until like right before trial, so I had no idea what was going on. They're looking at the police reports. So if that's all they had, they didn't know until that moment in trial, which was during direct, right? That's the prosecutor put them up. The prosecutor's asking the questions, and then that's when it comes out that her mom was home and her kids were home. The defense attorney had no idea whether by them not doing their job or by the fact that they believed what was in the police reports.
I get that. But my point is that the prosecutor opened themselves up to have her on the stand say, the police are lying.
Right.
Like they opened that up. They opened that up. If they knew that Sherelle had said if they're looking at the report, I understand why they think it's safe to ask that question on the stand, because the prosecutor's like, cool. She left, so there's no reason that she would know where Jody was. But then to have a conversation with a detective where they're like, I mean, was McGinnis like, by the way, she might say, oh, my kids and my mother. I mean, I don't know why, as a prosecutor, you go down that line when there's every likelihood that she's going to be like, and by the way, other people live in that house and the police are lying if it's not in that report. That's a big deal. I mean, obviously, it didn't save Jody, but that's the kind of thing where I'm like, that seems like incompetence on the prosecutor's part.
Yeah, my guess is, is it the prosecutor? So what if we don't know, right? But what if there is the conversation and McGinnis just didn't tell them?
Right.
McGinnis gives the report, right? So it doesn't necessarily mean they didn't have a conversation.
Right.
But McGinnis I'm telling you, this murder, here's a fun fact. McGinnis gave us the original murder book, the complete original murder book. What McGinnis doesn't know is that I already have the complete original murder book. That's what I already had.
I mean, I guess he probably knows it now.
Just now figured it out. Yeah. Guess what, buddy? The timesheet was in the original murder book that was turned over in a FOIA request in the past after trial. And now the original murder book doesn't have the timesheet in it.
Oof.
Whoops. Oof.
There's a witness that in the original murder book that McGinnis gave me, there's one report of one interview. It references there were previous interviews. But in the prosecutor's file, that is the copy of the original murder book, there's reports for every single time that they talk to this person. So why are those things not in the original murder book now? It's a backup file of the investigative file in this case. That used to be hundreds of pages and now is 137 pages.
Boy, that's not a great look.
Not at all.
I'm sure there's a perfectly reasonable and honest and pure explanation for it. That's going to be my assumption until proven otherwise.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Every everybody in the chat is definitely looking for that clarification as to the status of the defense attorney. Is it a public defender or is it a private, like being paid by Jody or Jody's family
attorney? It's a public defender.
Yeah.
And there was an issue, again, like I haven't dug into it enough to like fully present it, but from what I know right now is they had a court-appointed attorney that was working on the case for a long period of time that seemed to be doing a good job. And then something happened where that person got taken off the case and White got put on the case. And then White never talked to Jody until like right before the trial. That's what I've been told so far up now. That's all stuff we need to investigate. And what I'm saying is from when I'm on the horn right now, there was a time when the Innocence Project, the Cooley Innocence Project at Western Michigan University, had Jody's case. And they were and primarily what they're going to do is some DNA testing. And they weren't able to do anything because that's how these cases end up in my lap. Because, you know, all those Innocence Project of Texas cases, this case needs a full investigation and they're just not equipped for that. But they pulled a bunch of documents. And so right now I'm trying to find out, when did you get these documents? Who did you get them from? Because like that's where like the timesheet came from. So I need to know, did they get that from the defense attorney? If so, this is ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right.
If you got the defense file and it wasn't in there, but then you got it in a FOIA request, then it's a Brady violation.
Right.
So like when I said earlier that I'm extremely confident we're going to overturn this conviction, I am extremely confident we're going to overturn this conviction. But now it's the game of trying to figure out where stuff came from,
mm-hmm.
like who had what when.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the defense attorney has passed away now. He's not alive anymore. I think he died in 2017. So, you know, we're kind of, I'm in the mode right now between Innocence Project, Attorney General's office, everybody trying to figure out where all this stuff came from and when things transpired.
Right.
But what's very clear is the games that are being played currently by the Benton Harbor Police Department or Public Safety Department in the FOIA requests they're giving me, they're games. Like I said, like to give me a file claiming that this is everything, the original murder book, well, why in the prosecutor's file does the original murder book have all these reports in there that are now not in your report? Did someone take them out of the original murder book? And if so, when and why?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
That's a really good question. So in the case, I know that we are not attorneys. If there's an attorney in the chat, feel free to chime in. But so in the situation where this happens, I'm sorry to just dwell on this, but to me, this is just such a mic drop, like crazy moment in the trial where the prosecutor has to object to the answer that is given to the prosecutor by the witness that the prosecutor is questioning. They have to object. Then the defense attorney's like, I don't have anything to do with any of this. But now you have this information. If you're the defense attorney, you've just heard during trial that unbeknownst to you, ineffective assistance of counsel or Brady violation, unbeknownst to you, there were other people at home who did not leave, who would be happy to testify that Jody was home. So if you're the defense attorney, are you just like, whoops, I guess we'll just let that go? Because yes, it can't be used by the jury because it's hearsay. But it's also information that doesn't have to be hearsay if you can contact the mother. Is that a situation where it's like, well, the ball's already rolling. You can't say, Your Honor, sidebar, I'd like to approach the bench. I had no idea. There was no information. I need to be given time. We need to do a recess. I need to find out if I knew this. And if I did, I'd like to be given the opportunity. If I didn't, I'd like to be given the opportunity to contact, you know what I mean? Or is the defense attorney just like, oh, wow, okay, so three people who could have, whatever, you know?
Yeah, we're going to get into all that. And that's what earlier I said I was going to go through process because there's a couple people because like right now we're still in like overview, right? So like the first episode was kind of laying out background. The second episode, we got into like victimology, what happened that night. The third episode, we're getting into the alibi. And then this week we're getting into like, what are the main, like how did they get convicted? Then we're going to start going through the detailed process of, okay, this is what happened in trial. This is what everybody testified to. And we're going to start breaking that stuff all down. Because there's a couple people, there was a listener that, you know, like heard one little piece of something and like found online an appeals motion that has like a paragraph summarizing and referencing something that happened at trial. And they're like, no, but this happened, but it's not the full trial transcript. And I was like, we're going to get there. These seasons are long. So that's just know that's the process. We're going to go through every step of this trial along the way and go through, because like there's obviously a lot more to Sherelle Moore's testimony. There's a lot more to everybody's testimony. Right now, we're just pulling out the pieces of them that explain and corroborate the things that we need now. For some people, LaShawn Harper, Princella Tobias, that you heard from this week, Jody themselves, I was able to, okay, let me go personally go interview these people and ask them what happened. Other people, like I haven't been able to get a hold of Cornelius, I haven't been able to get a hold of Sherelle. For those people, I'll go through, okay, here's what they said at trial, so you know what was said there. So long story short, we're going to get into all of Sherelle's testimony when we get there. Right now, we're still trying to lay the basic groundwork of what happened here, and then we're going to dig into all the nitty-gritty details of it.
Okay. All right. Well, for all of you who had some great questions that build off of this whole conversation about the kids being there and the mom being there, sounds like we're going to put a pin in that. So hang in there because we can dive in more, hopefully very soon. Caroline says, Bob mentioned that not long after Mario was shot, word on the street was Jody was the murderer. Who started this rumor? Was it the police or the actual killer? Was there someone in Jody's life that connected them? Why Jody?
That's another thing we're going to get into a bit this week, but I will tell you this. One of the first witnesses that was spoken to by police that night, within minutes of this happening, the police officer started saying to a witness, asking them about Jody and asking them about the armed robbery. So like that's how it got around. Like nobody saw Jody there. Like even at trial, nobody saw Jody there. Nobody saw Jody going there. None of that happened. But it seems like from what I'm seeing so far that the police that were on the scene started putting that in people's heads right away because they were already suspecting Jody as being possibly involved in the robbery. And so like London, Officer London is the one that chased down Leon Newcomb mm-hmm. and caught him that night mm-hmm. of the robbery. He was there that night right away. And so he got there right away and recognized the car. And is like, that's the same car that was involved in this other armed robbery. And they figured out pretty quickly, okay, maybe this has some kind of connection to that. And so they start asking questions. Those rumors start spreading to the point when Sherelle and Nadia come by and they walk up to the scene. People around the scene are like, they're saying Jody did this, you know, because it's already like spreading around the crowd that quickly. That's why when she went home, she was, you know, and she says, I went home, Jody's sound asleep in bed. I wake them up and they're like, they're saying that you just shot somebody. And Jody's like, what are you talking about? I've been here sleeping this whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering how that came about too, because it just seems so strange that it's like all of a sudden their name is just out there immediately.
Yeah, and it's very like, and that's why I said it reminds me so much of the West Memphis 3 case. You know, when right away they pull the bodies out of the ditch and the probation officer says, oh, Damien Eccles finally did it. He finally killed somebody. And then immediately the investigation is not an investigation to figure out who the murderer is. The investigation is trying to build a case against this one person who they've already decided the murderer is. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so frustrating about that. And you could hear my frustration in it in the episode is I was shocked when I talked to LaShawn, and you guys kind of heard that part of the conversation, you know, because I interviewed him the same way I interview anybody. First, tell me what happened. Let's back up and go through some details of what happened. Let me find ways that we can corroborate what you're saying. And then it's, okay, well, how do you know? Because you said, I never count on times and dates. Like, I want to know, is there an anchor? How do you know? And when I was like, well, how do you know that you have the right date? He's like, because they came the next morning. They were there the next morning to talk to him. He told him then. They were there late that night. And then I found out later after the interview that they came back again. I believe it was McGinnis came back again, like a couple days later, and got the timesheet from Kenya and gave it to them. And then they had it the whole time. So then they didn't have the document anymore to pin down what times were what. And also they didn't know when they needed an alibi for, mm-hmm. and the timesheet was gone.
Interesting. I think in the interview, doesn't LaShawn say it was the chief who came in the next day and he didn't even remember if he said McGinnis came by later, but yeah, that it was actually the chief who came initially to say like, right, hey, this is going on, which yeah, I thought was interesting. Was the chief known to be at the crime scene? We know that the chief ate there, and sounds like McGinnis ate there all the time, too.
So. Yeah, I don't know. You got to keep in mind it's a small department. You know, yeah. There's not a whole lot of officers. The chief was obviously there in an investigative capacity. He was asking him about Jody's whereabouts.
Right.
So, it sounded like for sure it wasn't McGinnis that was there right away first thing in the morning, but was there as part of the investigation, right?
Yeah.
that happened. And then, yeah, McGinnis came by later. He did talk to McGinnis later. And then I found out that Kenya also talked to McGinnis later.
Okay, gotcha. Well, while we're on the subject of the spotlight being shone on Jody so quickly, Jessica just wants to circle back about the armed robbery itself and says, did Jody have an alibi for the armed robbery? Why was everyone at that point so convinced that Jody was involved? Was it just because of Leon and the known relationship between them, or?
We're going to dig into that pretty heavily. Okay. As I said, I don't know. It certainly seems like Jody is alibied pretty well for the armed robbery too, because Jody was on tether at the time of the armed robbery. Yeah. And had a curfew. And I know that I've seen through part of like Sherelle's testimony and some other, the problem is when you're reading the police reports, there's stuff missing from the police reports. There are things that are clearly missing from them. So it's hard to track some of this down, but that armed robbery happened sometime after 10 PM. And I believe Jody's curfew was 9 PM, which means if they're on tether, there really shouldn't be a possibility they were there. You're going to hear later that they kind of, the whole gold spray painted shotgun. Mm-hmm. That they found like some gold spray paint at Jody's house, and they found like a box of shotgun shells at the house, and Jody had spray painted their rims on their car gold, and so that was like their big evidence on it. But then I'm also hearing after talking to some people there that like that wasn't a Jody thing, that was a neighborhood, like a lot of people were doing that.
Well, even if Jody did it, they did have a relationship to Leon, so at some point, so it also could have just been like, well, Leon came over and used my spray paint. I mean, that doesn't, you know what I mean? That doesn't put someone at the scene.
Right.
Well, and Jody says in their interview, too, that they were staying with Sherelle because they were on house arrest, which is what the tether is. For people that don't understand that, that's essentially what the tether is, that they're on house arrest, what they would call house arrest.
Yeah, and it's an ankle monitor, and it tracks, and we were looking up last week because, you know, we thought, in kind of real time, and I don't even know what Erica left in and didn't leave in about that because I didn't listen to the episode. But yeah, because some of the units will actually track your GPS location at all times, so they could tell exactly whether Jody was there or not. But what they all have is you'll have a monitor in your house, like a transmitter, receiver, whatever, in your house, and it's set to an alarm that you have to be in your house by your curfew time whenever you're supposed to be there. So like, if the curfew set by the tether device was 9 p.m., that would mean that if Jody wasn't at the house by 9 p.m., alarms go off and immediately calls the police and everybody, you know, is out looking for them right away. So it should be very, very, very easy based on what I've read so far to figure out if Jody was involved in that robbery or not.
Do we know when their tether was released or anything like that?
It's all, the thing is, I hesitate to talk because, yes, I know. But I haven't confirmed it with documents. It's just things people have told me.
Got it.
Right? So like Sean told me that he thought that the day of the murder was the day Jody went, like why there's a gap in that timesheet, because he had to go to like an anger management class. Mm-hmm. Or excuse me, they had to go to an anger management class.
There is like a 3-hour gap. If you haven't seen it, there is like a 3-hour gap in the middle of the day.
Right.
Yeah.
And they said Jody was there, got there at like 1 PM, and then had to leave to go to an anger management class, and then got off of the tether. Like they finally took the tether device off that day. That's what I've been told. I have not confirmed that yet.
We can wait to talk about that. I can imagine how that would really go towards like the sort of legend building of like, and they were just waiting to get off tether so they could commit this heinous crime. Like you could see that going towards, you know, the building of a story, whether it's true or not. Julia says, I asked this in a separate post, but it got a lot of interest, so I thought I'd repeat it here. I noticed that Bob reiterated this timeline. Jody clocks out, then hangs out with their drinking coworkers, then gets a ride from Cornelius. However, LaShawn mentioned that the supervisor wouldn't have signed Jody out immediately after the shift ended, that the supervisor likely would have waited until the group was done to sign them out, i.e. like, it's kind of a thank you for working so late that maybe you would still get to drink a little bit, and then you wouldn't be signed out until after you were actually like walking out the door. And so Julia says, given that we're trying to work in worst case scenarios as far as constructing a timeline for the night, is it worth eliminating that particular 20 minutes or so? Could Kenya be contacted to see how she most likely would have handled signing staff out in this type of situation? Thanks.
Yeah. So Sean contacted Kenya to confirm that she had come through there that day. So the way that worked out, when I was talking to Sean, I was like, well, who signed? And that's when he said, well, the employee never signed themselves out. A supervisor signed them out, either me or my sister or whoever it was. And he's like, so it would have probably been me. Well, then when I talked to Jody was like, Kenya had come through that night and signed me out. And so then I sent the timesheet to Sean, and he's like, oh yeah, that's Kenya's handwriting. She's the one that did it. And then I was like, was she there that night? He contacted her, and she said, yes, she had come through and signed them out. But didn't remember much other than that, like many details. Like, they remembered that they were there that night, they signed them out, and that was the end of it. So if I spoke that in an absolute, I didn't mean to, and I shouldn't have, because I don't know. There is some ambiguity there whether the drinking happened before or after they signed out. Based on what Sean was saying, if it was Sean who signed them out, then he's like, and even he said, I probably would have not, I would have waited till after we were leaving,
right?
You know, when we were leaving to sign them out. But then now we know it wasn't Sean who signed them out. Based on what Jody's telling me, it was Kenya had like popped, just like Princella did, had just popped in,
right?
And then signed them out. So it could have been before the drinking, or perhaps during the drinking, but nobody knows. Kenya, from my understanding, is not able to like say for sure that they know exactly what happened there. They just come through and sign them out. So yeah, I don't know as far as that. So yeah, in a worst case scenario, and I thought I did work through, like, let's go worst case scenario and just say they signed out at 12:05 and left immediately.
Right.
Then that gets them home at like 12:17,
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Or, well, it's like 6 or 7 minute drive. So 12:13. And then, yeah. And then if they turned around and went straight to the crime scene, then it would have been, you know, around 12:20 that they could have gotten to the car, 12:17, whatever I had come up with. Mm-hmm. That also takes away the part that is confirmed by both Jody and Cornelius, that when they got to Jody's house, they sat out in the parking lot talking for about 20 minutes before Jody even went in. That also ignores Sherelle saying they had the argument when they got into the house. So, like, it really doesn't matter.
Right.
Especially when you hear this week's episode, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Whether the drinking happened before or after or anything like that. There's just no, like, Jody couldn't have been there.
Right.
Any way you shake it, Jody couldn't have been there.
And just as far as timesheets go, just for clarification, because obviously timesheets have been a big part of this podcast and the conversation around Adnan, it was normal for the supervisor to be the person's hand signing. Like, there would be handwritten, it wouldn't be like a time clock where this is like some kind of aberrant situation where it's like suddenly a handwritten timesheet appeared. This is the traditional, like, this is how this job clocked in and out, with the accountability of the supervisor being the person acknowledging, yes, you are signing out now. Like, that's all normal, right? It's not just that one night.
Yeah. And I see somebody in the chat said, like, that's kind of strange that, like, it's not literally that's how Erica's, what, you know, when she first started here, when she was hourly, yeah, we just had a paper sheet just like that. And I would just write, sometimes she would write them, sometimes that, but I would always like go through and verify and write in the hours. It was normal. I used to work at a golf course that was like that. And you had to, we had like time cards, like you would put in a punching timesheet, but mm-hmm. we didn't have a time clock. And when we left, we had to take the card to the boss, and the boss would write the time in it when we left. So, yeah. And also, somebody pointed out, they're like, oh, well, it says on the timesheet that the employee is supposed to sign it, but it's actually the supervisor who signed it. And why, like, this is like a thing from Staples or Office Depot. It's a generic timesheet that it says some stuff on it, but they just had their way of doing it. And the way they did it is they said they had it, they had the timesheets all, like, they would like staple them or pin them up to like sound like a bulletin board by the back door.
Mm.
And so they would just have all of them up there, and then the supervisors would go through and write the times in when people were leaving.
That makes sense to me. So some questions around the crime scene diagram, the numbers that you discovered that at first you and Erica thought might be addresses. Aaliyah says, in regards to the crime scene diagram with the series of numbers, if this document was made and used by law enforcement, wouldn't we expect the times to be in military 24-hour time, i.e. using the first time listed as an example, since it's just after midnight? It shouldn't be 12:25 as written in the diagram. It should be 0025. Is it not official documentation? Is it somebody who's just making a note of the times unofficially? Maybe it's a mistake. Maybe it's not times. So that's kind of the question around that. And Lynn also was kind of trying to figure out, like, are people taking different types of notes? Are they like accounting for time differently and all that?
Couple things. One, we don't know what those numbers are. I've concluded that they're probably times. Yeah, because based on the fact, obviously, they're not addresses, they're spans, they look like times. As far as the military time thing, because it was the same thing for the fire department. Like, in our official reports, we type them out, you type everything out in military times. But when nobody talks like that, right? So especially at midnight. The weirdest one of all of them is the 12 o'clock hour, the midnight hour, to say it's 00:12, you know, or it's 0:12 or 00:12, whatever. So that's always a common timer. People would just say 12, whatever.
Well, I think the other thing that we need to make sure that's addressed is the fact that this isn't an official report. This was chicken scratch
right
on the side, handwritten chicken scratch on the side. This wasn't like somebody had wrote a report. This was something right that was jotted quickly.
Yeah. And that was the other point. Yeah, exactly. That is, this wasn't typed into a report. Someone was drawing that out and then just wrote that stuff. And so like, if that information was then transcribed into an actual report, then I would expect it to say 00:25 to 00:27. But yeah, just that someone just writing it. And that's kind of what I was getting at. Like, at least for me and my experience with, you know, all the firemen, law enforcement that I work with, like your brains just don't work that way. Like, I'm looking at the clock, it's 12:25. I'm going to write 12:25.
Right.
When I type it into a report, I'm going to do it in military time.
So all the windows seem to be 2 to 3 minute windows too. What do we know what like an average 911 call would be? I know I tried to look it up. There's no like averages out there. I mean, they say a response time, they try to get somebody within 30 seconds in direction of it, but there's no actual like length of time.
No, it's all, I mean, so when I first started, for the first 5 years I was on the fire department, we still had a fire phone, which means like we took the 911 call. So if somebody called
it's back to Pinion Pines here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So if somebody called 911, the dispatchers would then transfer the call to us. And then we had to take the information. And so I've had them that were 25 seconds. You get on the phone, they're like, my house is on fire. This is my address. And we're like, all right, we're on the way. Hang up, hit the tones, and we go. Other times they're just, you can't get them to shut up. Like, you never know. You never know. I would think 2 minutes is probably around an average time, because sometimes, like, a good dispatcher will, once they know what needs to happen, because they use computer aided dispatch, like through their computer, they'll start sending units out or something like that, or they'll send a message to another dispatcher to start hitting the radio while they continue talking. There's a lot of variables there.
Okay. Because they all seem to be very like normal. It's like 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, or 2, 3, 2, or something.
Yeah. And this was also at the time that Benton Harbor was one of the few public safety departments that had their own dispatch. And that's what was going on with us too, back at this same time period in 2001. There was a county dispatch that dispatched most of the public safety departments in the county. And then there was, you know, some like where I was at and like the city of Niles had their own dedicated dispatch. Benton Harbor had their own dedicated dispatch. So the procedures are off a little bit. They did things their own way, so it's harder to know. Now everybody is dispatched by the county. The county has one dispatch center. 911 calls go to one place. They dispatch everybody. But back then, Benton Harbor had their own, which is unfortunate for us too, because if it was at the county, I would easily be able to get what I'm looking for, which is the dispatch log. But since it was, of course, at the Benton Harbor Public Safety Department, police department, who had their own dispatch, they control the flow of that information.
Right. And just to put a button on that temporarily, to reiterate, like, nothing on the diagram where those numbers were found, there's nothing about that corresponding information, the official information, that would help explain why those numbers were scribbled on there.
No idea. Like, we literally went there and went to the place where they're drawn on the map. Like, what did these numbers mean?
Sure.
And we're like, why are these addresses are all, none of these, what? And that's when I was like, oh, they're time spans, which I'm very confident they're time spans. I just don't know what exactly they are. Mm-hmm. Could be 911 calls. I don't know. But that doesn't seem to jive either, because there's all this crazy ambiguity around the time. Like, that is the most insane part about this case. And if it's not already becoming obvious, it will on Sunday, it seems to be very intentional that we don't know exactly when. And we also learned Sunday that they did pull. Not only that, they did pull the dispatch tape. They have the recording of all the traffic that was happening over the radio when all this stuff happened. So they knew exactly when this happened, without question. And they said, I'll tell you this, I can 100% without any question at all promise Mario Lowe's was not murdered at 12:40. I guarantee you, it is proven beyond all doubt that is a lie. He was not murdered at 12:40.
Psst. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
All right. We hate when you drop those little breadcrumbs about upcoming episodes, but it makes us also very excited and interested. I know we've talked about this a little bit last week, and I know that I'm sure there's more coming on this, but certainly this latest episode did prompt people like Brian and Lilias to say, why, Jody? What, was there a grievance there? We know you made it clear that, you know, Jody had had encounters with law enforcement, but we still don't have a clear picture of what that relationship with the department would have been like and why they would potentially have been targeted, other than that this person had a relationship with the other person in the Mario robbery, potentially.
That question is one of the reasons it's killing me that I can't get Jody on the phone right now, because I've heard rumblings. I've heard rumblings that there was a history between McGinnis and Jody. I'm not even going to get into what those were, because it's all just hearsay, but I want to hear from Jody, number one, if they're saying that's true and what those things were. But because, I mean, I'll straight up say it, from what it looks like to me, and you've never heard me say this before. You've always, in every season, anytime even there's some corruption, there's all the stuff that we obviously are able to prove, I've always said, like, this was not a frame job. Like, nobody's going after trying to go after this one person. That was just the easy way out. This looks like a frame job to me. This looks very much like there was a concerted effort to convict Jody of this crime when they obviously could not have committed it. And what we learned from Sean, they knew they could not have committed it within 12 hours of it happening. Like, this is the only time you've ever heard me say this. This, and I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying from what I'm seeing, this looks to me like Jody was intentionally framed for this crime.
Yeah. Well, you said, I mean, you always say about wrongful conviction cases when you're reviewing them initially, when you're just taking that very first look, when someone is claiming innocence, that the when you look at something closer, the case clarifies as falling apart versus it starts to make more sense. So it sounds like, based on everything we are learning, even now at the beginning stages, like, you had strong reasons to go, well, hold on. Usually I have to look a little deeper than this, you know?
Yeah, that's, you know, I always say that when I'm screening cases, I always say if you, like time, technology, and attention to detail should make a case stronger. And so I always say, like, when I get a case and people send me this and send it to me and they're like, here's all the reasons why I think this person's innocent. If I look at the prosecution's case and I start to put a microscope on it, 9 times out of 10, and a lot of the ones they send us, I'm like, no, I don't buy it. I mean, I've had people that, you know, lawyers that I've had Zoom calls with that went through a whole pitch process with cases with me. And it's like, I asked 3 questions and I'm like, like, you didn't, you know, it's just, to me, you're making a better case for the prosecutor. This is not getting stronger.
Right.
And we're not interested. But if I start looking closer and things start getting weaker and the case starts crumbling, then it's like, okay, there may be something going on here. I've never seen one like this. Yeah. I've never seen a case where you just pull back the curtain a little bit and there's the wizard. You know what I mean? Like, what?
The only one I can think, the only one it reminds me of a little bit is, was it George? You know, which was a very short, which took very little time, because it was like, this person is not 5'8". This person is well over 6 feet.
Right.
What are we doing here?
Yeah. And there's a lot of them, like, here? You know, like Sandy's case, like on its face, like in a very practical way, you're like, this is insane. She's locked in a closet with a, you know, like, but you still have to go through the process of, like, figuring all that out. And this one, the first step we always do is, like, to kind of try to profile the scene, look for an alibi. And it's like, the most real line you heard in that episode this week was me saying, if we use the actual times from this case, this conversation is stupid.
Right.
It's too stupid to even be talking about. And that's when I started, it's like, wait, like, surely these detectives are not this stupid. Surely they're not. 1 + 1 = 2. The crime happened at this time. We know exactly where the person you think did it was during that time. They didn't do it. Let's find out who did do it. But it sure seems like it was like, well, we'll find a way to make it fit.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't even seem like they had to, like, no one pressed them to, like, even try to erode the credibility of, oh, your friends will give you an alibi, or, oh, your work, you were closer to your coworkers than people know, so they could probably lying for you. Like, all these people would lie for you. This community's broken. Like, anyone will do anything. Like, it doesn't even seem like they were tasked to even make up any of that. It was just like way too easy for this to happen, which disconcerting.
None of these people had any like real loyalty to Joe. Princella, part of the interview, we didn't play her whole interview, but like she wanted to fire him. She came in and she told me, she's like, what's going on? Well, you heard LaShawn say that, told her like they were in here looking for Jody about a shooting. And she's like, I said, get rid of him. We're a new business. We don't need some gangbanger in here that was murdering somebody. Fire him. And he was like, and Sean said, it was when you came in to check on the lights, like that was the night. And she was like, oh, well, he was here. What are you talking about?
Yeah. And like, this is referring as everyone remembers, this is all in the context of them understanding him as Joseph, like understanding Jody
right, yes.
as Joseph, and those pronouns being used, just to be mindful of that. But those were the conversations around that. Yeah. That's crazy. Brian and a bunch of other folks, Maureen and Joni and Christy, interested in any cell phone data. I think this came up last week too. Will there be cell phone data to help support or not support any of this stuff in the actual case files?
The funny thing about framing a person for murder that didn't do it is, you know what you don't want to do? Find evidence. Because, you know, what they could have done is get the call logs and find out, when was Sherelle calling the restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
What they could have done, I believe DeMario had a cell phone. I believe they could have found out where DeMario was located, you know, or what calls they were making, or, you know, for some victimology, any of that. I haven't yet to see anything like that. Exactly what these listeners are asking. It's the same way my brain works. Like, okay, well, how can we prove this? What can we use? How can we use technology or anything, any anchor to try to figure out what's going on here? I've not seen any of that. I know none of it came out at trial. If it's in there, obviously there's gaps in the police file too. But no, it doesn't look like they made any effort to actually figure out who killed DeMario.
Well, I think you've said it. I've heard it in several places. You don't want to find bad evidence.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to, like, because again, I can't stress this enough. If I'm right about this, if everything we're hearing from the witnesses we've just heard up to this point, they knew, McGinnis knew, the very next morning that Jody was not responsible. So it's not like they thought, you know, even like Pinyon Pines, like they were working that angle and they were really pushing it for a while and they thought it was Javier, and then they were working on Robert. And then once they finally figured it out, then they stopped with the bad evidence because they didn't want to make it any worse. They knew, and the reason the investigation is shit is because they decided it was Jody. Looks like they found out it couldn't have been Jody. So then they're like, well, there's no sense. Like, what are you going to investigate? You know, any path you find is going to take you somewhere else. And that's why I say, like, this feels to me like they actually framed him, which is insane. I don't know why, if that's the case. And maybe I'm wrong about it, but it's like, this is a very, very obvious case.
Well, I'm going to stay as objective as possible.
I am
ready, willing. I'm wide open to any and all evidence and proof showing that, in fact, that is not at all what happened, or showing that the pressure was coming from elsewhere. And if it was a frame job, finding out exactly who would be responsible for that. I am wide open. I know that sounds sarcastic, but I am just as uncomfortable as everybody else when we find out that police are up to no good. It's very uncomfortable. It's very unsettling. I would love for us to be more wrong than right in situations like this, for society's sake. So I'm ready. I'm here. Hey, guys, I'm ready. Show me that Bob's wrong, please.
Yeah. Well, and just in everything you said, like you said, you sounded a bit, you're being honest. Like, you're really trying to keep an objective view at it. I'm doing the same thing. I realize that that's like, at this point,
you know more than we do, though. You know, I know more than we do, even just as simply as you know what the next episode is and we don't.
And I'm to the point where I'm like, you have to show me, like, I've looked at their evidence. I haven't even done my own investigation yet. I've looked at their evidence. And so think about this. Just what we know now, we have a timesheet that says Jody was at that job until at least 12:05. At least. We have the two employees that were working with them that night, both confirming they were there late that night. We have Jody and the other employee with no connection to them. They just recently had met, confirming they gave them a ride home and they sat there and talked for 20 minutes. You have the ex-girlfriend saying that we had an argument and then he went to bed and then I left. Which, by the way, the murder had already long since happened before most of this stuff happened. Mm. I cannot sit here and pretend that I don't know that that Jody's innocent. I can't even make sense of it. I can't even construct a make-believe unicorn fairy dust theory of how Jody could have been involved at this point. So for those of you that love it when you say I'm biased, you got me. This time I am. This time I am. I have through now, not based on preconceived notions, but based on simple investigative tasks, I'm convinced Jody's innocent. And it infuriates me because not only what's happened to Jody all these years, but also, like, did anybody give a shit who killed DeMario? Anyone?
It sure doesn't seem like it.
Well, I hate to break it to everybody, but I don't think that constitutes bias then. Ooh, sorry to make it awkward, everybody, but if I'm biased because I think a bee dies after it stings someone, that's pretty backed up by science.
Right. We'll see. They can have it. They can have the bias argument. Okay.
All right. Well, that's pretty much it for the heavy hitters. But I did want to touch on this. You know, we spoke about it a little bit, but I don't think the tape was rolling, as it were, last week when I mentioned that someone last week had a question about the cover art for the season. Caroline
last week
had said, can you tell us more about the cover art for the season? You had mentioned before, you know, as you drop that image, that there were some Easter eggs in there. There's probably still some that you don't want to quite give away yet, but could you just tell us more about it?
Well, I mean, Zach talked about the Easter eggs, and I feel like you overhyped it for me because there's not a whole lot there. Yeah, so yeah, the whole cover art, it's just an aerial map of the area showing that the river that divides St. Joe and Benton Harbor there. That's obviously a picture of Jody. There's the Benton Harbor Public Safety Department images on there. But then the artwork is, so that is from a picture that Jody had sent through JPay to another case advocate a while ago, and it kind of made its way to me. It was a picture of Jody, and then they had written, and people who have been wondering what that says, it says la-di-da, and because that is Jody's kind of nickname in prison. Like, a lot of people call them Da or la-di-da. So the colorful piece that's on there, that's actually Jody's artwork. How they had signed their name on that was la-di-da with the symbol and stuff on the bottom of it. So I wish there was more little trinkets that I had hid in there, but that's all great of it.
It's less Easter eggs and more just kind of a kind of cool representation of, you know, what the season is all about and who Jody is. And I love knowing that about the nickname. Yeah. That's definitely new information.
Yeah, because when the first couple episodes came out, the people were like, does that say Jody? But it doesn't. It says Lottie.
I think when I said Easter eggs, I was thinking because we dropped it before the season started. So
It was Easter eggs then.
Yeah.
It
was Easter eggs.
It definitely was. And then the other thing I would say too, and I know this is like out of sync with everything we've been talking about, but we didn't get any questions about Jody talking about their experience in prison. But I did just want to acknowledge that, I thought that Jody spoke with such compassion about being put into a room with people who did have real mental illness and real challenges and probably weren't being taken care of or treated for those illnesses the way they deserve to be. Even if they are prisoners, they are human beings. Our health is paramount. We all know that Sandy has struggled so much and has actually tried to move things forward for other prisoners. When Jody said, you know, I was attacked by someone who was not being properly medicated. I just thought they spoke about that very compassionately, especially when we're talking about someone who ultimately caused them to lose the vast majority of their vision in one eye. I thought that was really compassionate. And I thought it was really interesting to hear. That's why I think so many of us are so excited to hear more from Jody directly, just about the experience of getting permission to go on hormones while in prison, I think is huge. It's really interesting, but also being surrounded by people who think that being trans is a sickness, is a sin, all of those things. And just getting that perspective, I'm really looking forward, even though I think it's going to be heartbreaking at times, to hear more about that whole just way of life and the existence of you know, being in that situation under those circumstances. So I'm so glad that you gave us a little sprinkling of that.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, and by the way, you guys can thank Janet kind of saved the episode this week because I sent it to her to review it. But it was one of those where obviously we had the episode planned about the alibi, but I was able to speak with Jody a couple of times and get little bits of recording done. And I just wanted you guys to meet them. And when we had put together like the piece at the beginning with Jody and then into the alibi, you know, it felt clunky. But we're like, oh, it'll probably be okay. So we sent it to Janet to review, and she's like, the word we both used was disjointed. So Janet suggested the 1 minute of vocals in there to explain why it was clunky, made it a little bit better. But it was, sometimes episodes like that are hard to, they're hard to write because I have like the investigative work that we want to get done, but it's like, I have this other, this piece over here that I think you guys need. Cause you know, it's been a while since we had a season where you can actually get to know the person that we're trying to help. We start running through it from a production standpoint, like, when can we get to an episode where we can really, you know, use this? And there's not anything coming up soon where it makes sense. So we're just going to do it. It's also tricky. I wish when we had Ed season and season two, Ed would get 30 minutes on the phone. And if we got disconnected, he could just call me right back.
Yeah.
With Jody, they'd be like, okay, there's this 2 hour window where I might get the phone. Mm. And so we got to wait and wait and wait. And hopefully I'm in here where I can get to the soundboard and everything when they call. If they call, and then sometimes they'll call and they're like, okay, we have 10 minutes. And so it's so hard to just
goes by like that. Ugh.
Yeah. And there's been a couple of times where they've called and, you know, Eric and I have been out in the office and we just sat and just chatted for a little bit just to chat with them. But then when we're trying to like get something, so when you heard that, the second piece where they were talking about their life in prison, and then they get into talking about the biography that they were writing, you know, I didn't have it in. I don't remember if it was still in the audio where they came in and said, you have 1 minute remaining, but like, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Is we're like in the middle of talking and then the voice pops in and goes, you have 1 minute remaining. And then it turns into, okay, real quick, Bob, before it's over with, I want to make sure that you know that I'm writing this thing and I'm going to send you some stamps and I'm going to do this. And then like mid sentence, boop, it's over. Like that's the end of it. And then it's like, well, maybe they can call tomorrow. And then they go on lockdown and you can't hear from them for 2 weeks. So yeah, I wish we could have like a long form where we could just chat for a long time, but it's usually.
Let's get them out. Then we can have lots of long chats.
That's what I would like to do. I would like to.
I'm just happy we got to hear from Jody. We needed to hear from them, and this is great.
Yep.
Absolutely.
We've got a lot of work to do. I think you guys should be really. Are we done with questions? Because I'm about to go
to
my little.
Oh, good. Please. Go for it.
So we do. We have a lot of work to do. And this is fascinating for me. It's a super easy one to investigate so far. To piece things together, I want to thank some listeners who, and that's how this works, right? It's all crowdsourced. Everybody does their part, and we've already had instances which you're going to hear on Sunday where, you know, I break stuff down, I put the documents out, and people immediately. The one I mentioned, the one person that like had shared a little bit of like an appeals document, and that person is actually like disagrees with me seemingly about everything always. But so they were kind of putting it out to counter something I said, and it was something I knew about, but I wasn't planning on getting into it yet. And then that conversation spurred another listener to notice a few things from the documents that were already up. And then that information from both of them allowed me to like piece together something pretty revealing about the case. And we're going to be talking about that on Sunday. So make sure you tune in on Sunday. Make sure you come back in here. And for those of you that are listening to this on Friday and you're thinking, when can I join these YouTube lives? Because I want to be a part of it. Because we do have a bunch of people in the lives chatting live with us. It's Wednesdays. Wednesdays at noon Eastern time. If you're on YouTube, if you go to the Truth and Justice Podcast YouTube channel, subscribe and hit the notification bell. It'll tell you when we're going live. But usually it's every Wednesday at noon. With that being said, we will talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.